Boss Man Show here with Martin Sawa, the author of The Other Side of Success, a new book coming out. I have the book right here in my hands, people. Get this book right here in my hands. Martin has it behind him as well. The Other Side of Success, Money and Medium in the Golden State. Where, you know, Golden State is where California, where the Warriors are. the world champs out there, man. Martin, good to talk to you today. Happy New Year to you. How you doing?
Hey, Happy New Year to you, Boss Man. Thanks so much for having me on. It's great. And I really look forward to it and meeting your listeners in Atlanta. By the way, Curry put up 62 last night, so I think he's back.
Yes, indeed. Chef Curry, man, I love that guy, man. I'll tell you, last time I saw those guys play was December of 18 in Atlanta. They came to Atlanta in 18 and played the Hawks that night, and I saw them put on a show, beat the Hawks by about 30 points that night. So, yeah, I love your guys out there in Golden State. Now, Martin, we're talking about the teams back there in Oakland, man. So tell us, listeners, about your memories of the Warriors in Oakland and Oracle Arena and how that environment was out there with the A's, the Raiders playing that one complex out there in Alameda County. How was that, man?
Well, I grew up in a little town in rural Wisconsin and then went to school and lived in Chicago and briefly in Detroit and moved out west in 1973. I just threw everything I had in my car and, you know, left the snow and the cold behind. And Oakland at that time was a real exciting place. I mean, sports-wise, you had the A's, you know, who won World Series a couple of times. You had the Raiders, and they won the Super Bowl, and you had the Warriors, and they won a championship. So there was a lot going on in the social life in Oakland. I don't know, Boss Man, if you've been visited much there, but at that time there were bars and restaurants in an area called Jack London Square, and that's where I kind of hung out. One of them was called Uppies. It was owned by Gene Upshaw. You know, it was the all-pro lineman for the Raiders and his brother. So it was a real exciting scene.
Most definitely. Now, Martin, you got into commercial real estate. Tell us about how you get into that business and give us kind of the perspective as a developer and trying to get projects off the ground. How was that, man?
Well, I didn't have a normal, I shouldn't say normal, but what would be typical for someone getting in the business today. I didn't start till really late. I was almost 30. I was in a dead-end job, and I just quit one day. And my wife, she just had her baby girl, and I was broke. And so I kind of clawed my way from the bottom. And I was a broker at first and eventually affiliated with firms in San Francisco, which at that time was sort of the financial center of the West. And eventually started doing bigger and bigger deals, selling high-rise office buildings, shopping centers, technology parks. Then I kind of got bored with that, and I quit one day, even though I was at the top of my game.
Wow. That takes a lot to walk away when you're at the top of your game.
Yeah, well, that's why you got to read my book, The Other Side of Success, to find out why I made that decision. But I then became what I would call an operator, an investor, and I had a business partner who I knew and trusted. So we would go out and buy properties, and I get on the big deals. You need to find other people's money because it takes an insurance company or pension fund to kind of swing these things, or a foreign investor. So we would get the money, and then we would be the operating partner, and we would try to add value and so forth. And then that changed too, where I reinvented myself for the third time and became a developer. And we had a large project in downtown San Francisco, $400 million. It was a mixed-use project, had historic buildings, shopping mall, residential component. And after that, I stepped out of the game again because I wanted just to pursue other things. So that's kind of my short history. It may not be typical of most people who, you know, get in the business today.
Now, Martin, what's the difference between commercial and residential real estate? How's that different? I know, I guess there'll be more so with the homes, it'll be more so residential, and the commercial's more like a mall or a plaza or something like that, or high rise. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a simple definition would be you have home sales, that's residential, and then you have everything else, and that's commercial. So it could be a shopping mall, it could be a self-storage facility, it could be a hotel, even apartments for rent are put in the commercial category versus if you owned a condo, that'd be like owning a single family home and that'd be residential. The two different mindsets. Before I got into real estate, I was thinking that I want to get into residential, but I wasn't emotionally suited for that. Commercial, it's more of a business. It's more what the numbers say. And so that I would just felt I was more suited to that.
Now, Martin, as we grow from the shopping mall era, like I know certain towns I go to, since I see a lot of malls are kind of desolate. They're kind of empty. And with the boom of Amazon and online shopping, and a lot of these empty malls now. So what's gonna happen to all these empty mall spaces where that was big and selling real big, but now with COVID, the online shopping aspect of it now, how do you see the properties of commercial sales when it comes to malls, residential, and places like that where you can buy stuff online and not have to go to a physical store anymore?
Yeah, the COVID is just accelerating changes that were already taking place for probably 10, 15 years, ever since Amazon. Amazon has changed the landscape for a lot of industries, including writing. But it's impacted commercial real estate probably as much or more than any other impact it's made. It's rendered a lot of malls obsolete. And America was really over-retailed, you know, at 20 years ago. There was just too much retail space. And you probably already saw then you may have these like malls and they would have two levels and on the second level would be the tanning salon and things like that. And you couldn't really lease that space, but they just kept building more and more. So Amazon put a lot of these malls out of business and COVID has kind of accelerated that. So this is there's going to be a lot of reuse. People are trying to figure out, and it really real estate is location specific.
Most definitely.
So it depends where it is, and these malls will be converted. Some will be converted to maybe data centers, some to warehouses if they work physically, some to other uses, and that'll be one of the opportunities, I think, in 2021 and the years to come, is how you repurpose these retail malls.
It's a mall close to my home here in Atlanta where the Dillard's is gone, the Macy's is gone, the Sears is gone. All that is a Penny's. It's the foundational store of the mall, and the rest of the mall is kind of like, you know, a suite here, suite there, suite here, suite there. And now they have a gaming place in there now on the second level of the mall. So, like, I'm seeing it like what you're talking about right in my face, where the mall's kind of just fading away. The big foundational stores are gone, but the restaurants still out here. All the others, like the T-Mobile cell phone companies, but the actual mall, the foundational stores are gone now.
Yeah, and there's hundreds of thousands of these across the country, and they're struggling. And what happens, major tenant leaves, like the Macy's or the Penny's, but they may be on a long-term lease. They're still obligated to pay the rent. So the owner of the mall can still pay the mortgage from the holdover rent paid by these large tenants. But then he starts losing the small shops, and then the small shops move out, and you know, the gaming things come in, or batting cages or whatever. And it's just on a downward spiral. And when he's no longer able to pay the mortgage, he gives it back to the bank. And then they try to find a developer, and it may be able to be reused, or it may be a scraper, and you wind up building apartments for the value of the land.
Wow. Now, Marty, talk about it in your book, getting skinny in the game. Talk about skin. I know what you mean by that, about playing sports. I know about getting skinny in that game in that regard. Talk about that in the real estate world, getting skinny in that game.
Well, skin in the game is a central theme of my book. Not just in commercial real estate, but in all aspects of my life. And all the, it's the difference in how you respond.
Yes, indeed.
And you know, you're an entrepreneur. You need to put butts in the seat. You need to have your listeners. You need to wake up every day, have an interesting show.
Yes.
Or that's it for you. Right?
Yeah, they're right.
It's not like having a real job where, you know, you take off or still go in and operate at a lower level and still get paid. So it makes you keenly aware of, and really when it's great, it's really great because you're your own boss. You have freedom of choice. But when it's not so great, that's when you get really tested. And believe me, everybody gets tested.
Yeah. Oh, yes. And especially being a long ranger here, since I am, you know, this is my baby, you know, this is it. You know, I have to make sure I'm the booker, I'm the advertiser, I'm the host, editor, social media. It's all me. So as you said, man, but I love it, though. It pays off because I know every week that I put all the hard work in, and the part I'm talking to you is the easy part, but this is the part off the air that people don't see is the hard part.
Yeah. And in commercial real estate, the stakes just get bigger and bigger. And when you're involved in these multi-$100 million projects, you have major institutions that put up most of the money, but they still make you put your skin in the game, and you have the time, and they take a long time, and you can work 10 years and then not have it pay out. So it was more than the money. It was, for me, the juice. It's that adrenaline rush that I got from closing these big deals and negotiating with business titans, you know, people whose names you see in the paper, and winning, and then getting the crap kicked out of me on the next deal. So,
oh yes. Now, Martin, this is a key subject here: gentrification. And you're a planner for a city, Atlanta, as you probably know, most metropolitan cities are. They try to gentrify some certain areas of the city. And being a planner, how do you combat that as a planner? And how do you think about the citizens who are getting moved out for the new project or the new thing coming to town or this side of the neighborhood? Because, you know, people are hurt by that. You know, I tell you all the time, we see that Publix or Starbucks, somebody paid a price for that and by moving out of his neighborhood for you. And, if you know, for me, coming from an area that's been gentrified right now, I see when I go back to my neighborhood, I'm like, wow, how it's changing up over the years.
Yeah, and this is such an important topic, and it changes with time and one's kind of perspective, and you can't put toothpaste back in the tube. The Bay Area in the years that I've lived there, the years before and after the millennium, was a time of really major physical, financial, social population change. When I moved to Oakland, the Black population had grown and in another few years would exceed the white population. But there was also Vietnamese coming in after the war. You had Chinese communities, Chinatown and Oakland. You're starting to see increased immigration from Mexico, legal and illegal. So it's this just kind of huge churning melting pot. And then when technology in Silicon Valley became the driver of the economy in the Bay Area, that's when gentrification really started to happen. And the cost of living, the cost of housing shot through the roof. And that's when in Oakland, the Black population started to decrease. People started moving back to the South, to Texas, just because they couldn't make a go of it. And in San Francisco, things just got and still are ridiculously expensive. So our major project called City Place, it was right on the edge of the Tenderloin. And it was a redevelopment project meant to revitalize the area. The Tenderloin was kind of where all the bad things happened. And it took us, we tried to do it, you know, sensitive to the needs of the local residents. We financially assisted our tenants. A lot of them were like hospital sponsored and socially sponsored businesses to help the homeless. We only scraped dilapidated structures already that didn't have much use and restored historic structures. So we tried to do it in a sensitive way, but it's the way life works. The only thing certain is change. And in the Bay Area, it was like really a lot of change.
Oh yeah, and when the Falcons rebuilt Mercedes-Benz Stadium, tore down the Georgia Dome, the area from Vine City is where I pretty much came up from over there. It's like, you know, you can see where they're changing things around and, you know, that whole English Avenue area where Clark Atlanta is, Spelman, Morehouse, you just see it happening. I'm like, yep. And people are getting kind of forced out. And also, Mark, talk about this, how sometimes you use the eminent domain from a city can just, you know, use that to get the land from people as well. You take this offer, well, we use eminent domain and take the land anyway for our use.
Yeah, the laws have changed on that over the years, you know, compared back to, you know, 50, 100 years ago, or like New York when Robert Moses, I don't know if you've heard the name.
But I've heard the name.
Kind of the director of developer, and they would just take out whole neighborhoods to build a freeway, like through the Bronx. And then the rules now, it's harder to the uses that you can make of eminent domain. So I don't think you see as much going forward, just these wholesale removals of neighborhoods as you did in the past. But it's a tricky issue. You know, you need the new business to revitalize an area, but then at what expense? It's always a debate.
Most definitely. Now, Martin, talk about the immigrant experience. You came from your parents from the Ukraine. You went back there to kind of find out your roots, and you met your sister before she passed away. Talk about the immigrant experience, and you know, coming up, moving to a new country here, Wisconsin, going to California. So, to kind of lay out how that was, man, being an immigrant in the United States, man, and how you were treated differently, and how you see the U.S. from your perspective of being an immigrant coming over here now.
Yeah, it really shaped my experience probably as much as anything. My parents were born and lived in Ukraine under the regimes of Stalin and then Hitler and then Stalin again.
Wow.
So this was as bad as it could be. It was the scene of the greatest mass killing of civilians, probably in human history. The area between Moscow and Berlin, you know, when Stalin and Hitler were in power. So they escaped with their lives. They saw their friends, family members killed, sent off to camps. And then after the war, it took them 4 years because the quotas were restricted. And they were lucky that they finally found a sponsor and they increased the quotas that year and were able to immigrate here. So they were resettled in a small town in rural Wisconsin because the policy at that time was to resettle in kind of in the hinterland and not concentrate in the populations, you know, like in New York or Toronto, where there was like Ukrainian ghettos like there were, you know, for other ethnic groups. So the best way to put it is they were taken advantage of when they first got here. They worked kind of for free. People didn't know what a Ukrainian was. This was the McCarthy era. So we were suspected of having communist sympathies. Despite all of this, for them it was heaven. That's the best way I can put it, relative to where they came from.
Oh, yes.
And that's what, like, generations today, they just don't understand what it was like and the mindset that people have. So they valued, and the other thing is they would live through their children in terms of trying to get for the kids what they didn't have, you know, the best possible education and so forth. So believe me, I appreciated from the time I was little to the present day what I have and how lucky I am. I don't know if that helps.
Oh, no, you're good, man.
That's my mindset.
Hey, no, man. Hey, what you're saying is so true because, you know, for me, I have the same kind of, not from as an immigrant, but I came up from a rough start to get where I am today. So to be where I am today, entrepreneur, I'm on radio show, being able to talk to you today. Man, you know, knowing where I started and where I had to go to get here, man, it's rewarding. So I feel your sentiment, man, the way, hey, every day is a great day for people like you and I.
To wake up on top of the grass, boss man, it's a good day.
Yes, as they say, it's better to be seen and not viewed. That's what they always say. It's better to be seen and not viewed. So that's the line I've always been told my whole life. So that's what I go with. As long as you see me, we're good. I don't want you to be viewing me right now, so I'm good. Now, Maury, now you've dated interracially your whole life, man. So tell us about that. Because, you know, in the South here, that's still kind of frowned upon in some parts of the South. Now, in Atlanta, it's okay. But, you know, parts of the South down here in the South of the United States, that's kind of an issue for some people still. So how is that for you dating interracially and learning a different culture from your own and intermingling and mixing that way? Because I feel like it's a great thing, man, that you had to experience.
Well, growing up in this little town, there weren't any black folk, or really, it was all kind of Northern European immigrants. So when I moved to Chicago in 1968, fresh out of high school, and that's when I sold Fuller Brush Products door to door, there was a lot going on. There was the Martin Luther King Jr. It was assassinated like several months earlier. So the whole West Side was like burned out. I mean, the riots were like 20, 30 people killed and probably 2,000 homes and businesses destroyed. It was, and then there was the Democratic National Convention in a couple of months. So it was kind of chaos. And while I went to school there, I did some community-based work with the Disciples Street Gang on the West Side. And they're not like the gangs today. They and the Blackstone Rangers on the south side, they'd have 10,000-15,000 members. That was my introduction to urban living. And then I moved to Oakland in 73 and still didn't date interracially. I had a girlfriend who I was going with who moved out with me later from Wisconsin. And then that relationship ended. So it wasn't until 1977, that I met my first wife. She was a Choctaw Indian, 100% Native American. And we met at a bar in Jack London Square.
Wow,
and
right
kind of hit it off. And got married a year later. And so that was my first interracial dating experience. But again, the skin in the game, she had two sweet children from a prior marriage. So, and she was pregnant with her daughter. So there was all these responsibilities now. And I had, you know, family to support. And at that time I was having financial issues. I was in a dead end job. And that's kind of when I made a decision. I had to change my life. Subsequent to that, we divorced in the mid 80s. And then I dated. And again, if you could picture Oakland now and the clubs, it was like just, it was a really great scene. And most my friends socially at that time were either the extended family from my marriage to Wanda or people I had met. And eventually I married Anita, who was a Black woman. She grew up in the rural South on the outskirts of Mobile. And that relationship, she was a charismatic woman on top of that. And none of the women I married were shrinking violets. If you could picture, you know, a confident woman with Southern values.
Mm-hmm.
She calls it as it is. Yeah. So, and then that marriage ended with her passing. And then my third and final marriage was to Virginia. And she was also grew up in the rural South in the Macomb area near Jackson, Mississippi. And again, was made herself and succeeded. And it's been a great experience.
And Martin, how was it trying to learn about the difference between the races, between like a full-fledged Native American versus a Black woman, and you've been Ukrainian and from European descent. So how was it trying to mend you all's backgrounds together and learn about one another's backgrounds?
Well, that's the key feature. When you're in an interracial relationship, it's not like some stereotypical views that one race is predominates or superior to the other. We had our life experiences and we learned about in detail and day to day what those experiences were and how you deal with people and treat people. And kind of the operating philosophy through the years that I had was no matter what race the person is, and this isn't just in love, but in business, I dealt with, you know, a lot of foreign investors. I dealt with Chinese and the Japanese, you know, the height of their investment in the 80s, and Israelis and, you know, Russians. And my philosophy was always to look the other person in the eye, at eye level, kind of, and feel neither superior nor inferior. And that goes both ways. And so I would engage And if that person felt the same way, then we would have a relationship. And if they didn't, then we just move on. And so it's not easy. And in the book, I used kind of a comparison, particularly in the kind of day and age we're living in now, with all the stuff on social media and just the constant pounding. To deal adroitly, it's like a Zen monk disarming a samurai. You don't do it with force or with, you know, negativity back or yelling. You do it with being adroit and understanding the situation and not being afraid, but treating the person as a person. I know it sounds corny, but that's really the only way it works.
That's not corny at all, because I try to treat everybody the same. It comes on my show, treat you with respect. I try to build a relationship with you through the radio here with my listeners here. So I want people to see you for who you are, and I don't judge people. I'll talk to anybody in the world, you know, as long as they disrespect me, I respect you back. You know, as long as we don't get disrespectful, we're good. Now, I've only had two bad interviews in my career, which is good for being on the radio for over 8 years. And the two that I had that were bad. But for 2 8 years, man, it's pretty good. So people to be about you. Anybody has a story I want to share with the listeners, audience here in Atlanta, so they can hear about it and grow from it. Because I want to help people grow at my radio show. Educate them, entertain them, and empower them with new content. That's what I want to do here in the show. And I think it's great that you say that, Martin, because treat people as people as people. That's a great thing to take away from this interview. Like, treat people as people, because we all bleed the same blood. We all as people. You know, let's treat each other as such.
Yeah. And it's, you know, in Ukraine or, I mean, in any part of the world, it's the same. You have people with differences. Sometimes it's visually apparent, like in skin color. Other times it could be just two ethnic groups that look alike. But there's always differences, and you have to deal with the differences, and it's how you respond. And so,
most definitely. Now, Martin, talk about this, man. You grew up in being a Catholic. You left the church. You came back to the Catholic Church. So talk about that journey, religion, spirituality, going from going and being brought up into it to leaving and coming back to it. And what brought you back to the Catholic Church there?
Well, I grew up as Roman Catholic, in this little town. I went to Catholic grade school, and then I went to a Jesuit high school. And that was actually one of the big experiences of my life. I learned far more in high school than I ever did in college or later from an academic standpoint. The Jesuits are the branch of Catholic religion that are kind of more the intellectual, the deep thinkers. So, but then when I went to college, it's probably like for a lot of people, you just lose your way. You stop practicing, and America just became increasingly secular, I think, after the 60s to the present day. So it wasn't until I met my second wife, Anita, who was religious. She read the Bible every night. She wasn't into the ritual. You know, her mother was Pentecostal, and she just thought there was, you know, it was like lasted all day and a lot of yelling and testifying. But she adopted her own formula. She read the Bible. She did these elaborate commentaries. She wrote in the margins. And most important, she practiced what she preached. And she led by example. So I admired her a lot and kind of gradually started getting back to my religion. And then many years later, I went to a retreat. It was a Jesuit retreat. And after that, that's when I started practicing again. So
now, Martin,
that was a journey.
Now, Martin, and I also read where, you know, losing your second wife, you know, and learning how to cope with loss and grief. I know I've had I've lost people close to me and having to deal with that. So how did you cope with losing someone who was that meant so much to you and trying to overcome and keep pushing forward after losing somebody that meant so much, brought you back to religion and helped you in so many ways?
Well, there's a saying that if life doesn't get your attention, death will. And I think death, it's such a huge thing, and it depends so much on the nature of the relationship and the age and other factors of the person that dies. So this was not only my wife, but my spiritual mentor. And it was, and it wasn't a long illness. She literally dropped dead one night. So there was no last words. There was no saying goodbyes. There was nothing. And that, it just affected me briefly. I considered suicide for a while and tried to find how to cope with it. You know, I went and saw a psychologist, but that didn't work. And then I started just doing my own research and try different things. But the thing that made the biggest difference was my interaction with a psychic medium whose name is Mary Jo. And I know a good segment of your listeners now are going to start rolling their eyes. And I'm not here to tell people, you know, what they should believe or not believe. Because I was a skeptic for a long time. But Anita and I met this woman, and she was a psychic medium. And she looked normal. She was like a suburban housewife and good Christian woman. She just had some skills. And I got to know her over the years, both as advisor and friend. And how it's done is a mystery, but there's a tiny percentage of people who advertise themselves as psychics. Most don't have the skills, or it's just kind of a fraudulent deal. But there's a tiny percentage who are extremely skilled and can provide valuable information through unexplainable means. And you know, a little bit, by now, I try to experience life directly and not take other people's word for it and put skin in the game. And so when Anita passed, I connected with Mary Jo, and she just told me it was too early to talk and I had to get my, you know, stuff together and get my life together and then, you know, call her back. So she wasn't like pressing me. That's the way she was. She, in fact, discouraged me from talking to her other than a couple of times a year. So it wouldn't be like a crutch. And eventually she was able to connect me with Anita, and our relationship survived after her physical death. And there was nothing bigger in my life.
Now, last one I got for you before we have you talk about your book one more time here. You lived in SoCal and NorCal. Which part of the state did you enjoy the most and why, man? Because I've been to both parts of the state. I've been to SoCal and NorCal multiple times, man. I like it out there. It's not humid as it is here in Georgia. It's very humid here in Georgia. The air is real nice out there. It's not too hot, not too cold. So talk about living in NorCal and SoCal, man. Which one you like the best out in the Golden State out there?
Well, there's no perfect place, boss man. Every place has its pluses and minuses. I loved LA. I loved the warm weather and the beaches, kind of the vibe. And there was a lot of business to be had. But at the same time, as my wife Anita pointed out, it's a land of illusion and delusion. And it feels at times just like a big Hollywood movie set. And there's that fake aspect that it's part of that scene. At least that was for us. San Francisco, on the other hand, it's cold and foggy, but it was the financial center of the West Coast. And then Silicon Valley, when the tech industry grew, it grew into San Francisco. So it was a great place to go and make money and to visit. But I lived there for a couple of years. And again, the vibe was just off for me. It's not a great place to raise kids. And at that time, my daughter was like at a really formative age. She was like 6, 7, right after our divorce. And it had then, and probably still has, the lowest percentage of households with children of any large city. So I just didn't like the vibe. And so I've always, when I lived in the Bay Area, would live in the East Bay and Oakland, or lived in Piedmont, Berkeley. Just the folks were a little, it had a working class reputation. And the folks just seemed to me a little bit saner. So,
most definitely.
But again, it's pluses and minuses.
Most definitely. Now, Marge, if I listen here, tell them how they can get your book that I have in my hand right here and right behind you as well. How can they get your book and give them that one last pitch to go out here and buy this book, man, and learn more about the side of success, man. I want them to buy this book, Bob Martin's book, but I'll let them tell you a little bit more about it for you so you can go out and get it after this interview airs.
Yeah, so the book is called The Other Side of Success, and the subtitle is Money and Meaning in the Golden State. And as you could probably tell by now, it's not just a business bio, but it's a memoir that gets pretty raw and personal and tries to be as real as you can. So it's available for sale online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, other major booksellers. You can check it out a little bit more on my website, martinsawa.com, or on social media. And for your listeners only, boss man, I give an ironclad guarantee that if they buy it and don't finish it and don't like it, I'll give them their money back. That's a special deal today only.
Gotcha. You got it from Marty. You got a special deal, boss man, listeners. You got it from him. But I'm going to tell you, I read the book. I enjoyed it. You will enjoy it as well, because a lot of you to learn from, a lot of nuggets for you. Get the nuggets, get the breadcrumbs, and learn from this book and apply them in your life as well, people. Martin, thank you for your time. This is fun to do this, man. I know it's first time doing it, but I'm glad you did it, man. I told you it'll be painless. It'll be fun, man.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, boss, man. I really enjoyed it. It was great. And, you know, maybe the next time you really put me on the hot seat.
Oh, no, hey, I'm about love and positivity, Mark. That's not me. Hey, other shows for that. This is not this show, man. We don't do that. We want you to be happy and having a good time and smiling, man. We're not here trying to, we're not a gotcha show.
Yes, okay.
Mark, thank you, later. Man. Hey, have a happy new year to you and talk to you real soon. Be safe now.
Same to you.
All right, now.
See ya. Bye. Bye now.